Welcome to Fireside Markets, your audio home for thoughtful and insightful discussions of financial markets, investment strategies, economics, retirement, and more. Fireside Markets is hosted by James Osborne, president of Basin Asset Management, a Colorado registered investment advisor.
Hello, this is James Osborne, and you're listening to Fireside Markets. Today, we are taking a look into behavioral finance and why investors are often their own worst enemies. Today's guest is Morgan Housel. Morgan is a columnist at The Motley Fool and The Wall Street Journal. He is a two-time winner of the Society of American Business Editors and Writers Best in Business Award. Morgan, welcome to Fireside Markets.
Thanks for having me.
Morgan, to get us started, talk to me a little bit about why behavioral finance seems to be the rage. Why are we all talking about this right now?
You know, I think there's so much evidence that how finance is taught in school as sort of a math-based subject, where it's taught like physics, I think, where here is your formulas and here is your data, and put your data into your formula and it's going to give you an answer. And that's how it's taught. But I think in the real world, finance and investing is so much different. 30 years ago, there was this investor named Dean Williams, who gave a really good speech on investing. It's one of my favorite speeches. And he made this analogy between investing and physics. And he said there are two types of physics. There's classical physics, which is it teaches you that the physical world works in ways that are predictable and make sense. So give me a ball and a ramp, and I can tell you exactly how far that ball is going to roll down that ramp. It's clean and it makes sense and it's predictable. And then there's another kind of physics, which is quantum physics, which tells us like the world is so much more messy and irrational than we think it is when you're measuring atoms and small particles and whatnot. And in quantum physics, you don't even know what you're looking at, or you don't know if the act of looking at something is going to change how it acts. Like, it's just a much more messy, uncertain view of the physical world. And the analogy that Dean Williams made is that investing is much more like quantum physics than it is classical physics. It's messy and it's uncertain, and a lot of times it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And the reason is because so much of investing is behavioral rather than math-based. And if you look at the best investors, I think you'll see that they have a much bigger edge in psychology than they do in hardcore finance as it's taught in schools. They really have control over their emotions, and that's what makes them great investors over time. And how finance is taught in school, that's really something that anyone can master and figure out for themselves. And so much of that can just be outsourced to a spreadsheet these days. And you know, whether you can make a discounted cash flow model in your head, well, that's great. A lot of people can do that. You can get a Capital IQ account and do that with one mouse click and do all the calculations you could ever want with a Bloomberg terminal or something. What's going to set you apart as a great investor is whether you have control over your emotions, whether you can prevent yourself from buying high when the market is surging and panicking when the market is crashing and selling out. If you can control that, that's what's going to set you apart. And I think that's becoming much more clear in the last decade or two. And it's been a big gift to the financial community that that's taking off and people are paying more attention to it. And I really think that's going to become more clear going forward. Now that, you know, so much financial information has been is public now, much more than it ever was in the past, just because of sites like Yahoo Finance and Google Finance. There's so much data that's available to the public right now that calculating numbers and crunching numbers is really not much of a skill anymore. It really comes down to psychology these days.
Yeah, and the perfect reflection of this is that last year, Gene Fama, father of the efficient markets hypothesis, and Robert Shiller, who essentially said, no, that can't possibly be true, shared a Nobel Prize. Do they both offer value?
We know it's interesting. There's been a lot of controversy, I think, that, you know, how do two people who it seems like think the opposite things, how do those people share the Nobel Prize in the same subject? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And in one, I think there's some truth to that, that it is kind of funny that these two men disagree on so much and share the Nobel Prize. And I think that's a good reflection that economics is a messy field. And it's not like math where we can just say 2 + 2 = 4 and that's the final answer and no one argues against it. Economics is really dirty and messy. But I think the thing with Shiller and Fama too is I really don't think they disagree on that much. And really, I think what it comes down to is that Fama, I think, thinks that the market is efficient 100% of the time, or maybe 99% of the time. And Shiller thinks the market is efficient probably like 95% of the time. Right. So I think that the difference between Shiller and Fama is pretty small. It's just that Shiller thinks that every 10 years or so, the investing public goes stark raving mad and we get a huge bubble. But it's a pretty rare occurrence. You know, I'm pretty sure, I don't want to put too many words in his mouth, but I think if you ask Shiller, he would say the market is very efficient most of the time. It's just that small subset of the time that you get bubbles. So there's, you know, there definitely is quite a bit that I think they both agree on. It's a pretty small gap that they disagree on, but it's a very important gap, obviously. If you are firmly in Fama's camp and you really think that bubbles can only be seen in hindsight, you know, that's a very different way than if you're someone like Shiller and you really believe in the idea that you can look at what markets are doing today and say, this is wrong, this is crazy, and because of these factors, these securities are mispriced. It's really going to influence how you invest over time. But I think from an economic standpoint, from an academic standpoint, those two agree on much more than people think.
I agree. I think there are a lot of people who want to take Shiller's research and sort of beat Fama over the head with it and say, look how wrong you are. People are irrational. People don't make efficient decisions. People are terrible investors. And that's true for a lot of things. People do make terrible decisions. And we'll talk a little bit more about that here as we go. But I'm of the opinion that most people should act that the markets are efficient enough most of the time. And the best explanation of the efficient market hypothesis I've heard recently was Noah Smith wrote a piece a few months ago, and he said the financial value of information gets used up, which I think is this concise, simple way to understand that no, markets aren't perfect. But the odds that you have an informational advantage over the market are very, very slim.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think there's another point too that people will look at huge price swings, you know, a stock that falls 30% in one day and say, look, that's an example that the market is not efficient. But that's really, I think, a misunderstanding of what the efficient market hypothesis is. Because right. if you have a big news release that comes out, you know, or you have OPEC that has this decision that people weren't expecting, you know, you're still going to have huge price swings in a market that is pretty efficient.
Right. We should see the market as an open place for financial debate over the intrinsic value of a stock or the market in general. And as that debate goes on, we should see price changes.
And, you know, in a market that is perfectly efficient, which I don't think exists or ever will exist, but even if it was perfectly efficient, you would still get bubbles, I think. You would still get crazy periods where people are optimistic about the future, but maybe it's rational that they're optimistic, and then something, a big event like 9/11 happens that throws that optimism off course. And in hindsight, you can say, look at those crazy people, they were all so optimistic. But if you were to go back in time and see, you know, what they were thinking, you might be able to say, well, you know, in hindsight, you were wrong. But at the time, this wasn't so bad at all. You know, you people weren't that crazy at the time.
Do you think that that's fair to say about 2006, 2007?
I think with 2006 and 2007, what's important is that housing was clearly a bubble. I think finance was a bubble. I do not think the stock market was a bubble in 2007. And it gets very quickly thrown around that people just say the stock market bubble of 2007, you know, peaked in October 2007. And that seems like a rational statement because you can say, look, stocks fell 50% after that. Of course it was a bubble. I really don't think that's true at all. I think NASDAQ in 1999 was clearly a bubble. But to say that the S&P 500 in October 2007 at whatever it was, 16, 7 times earnings, to say that it was a bubble is not really the case. Sure, markets fell 50% after that, but that was because we had a financial crisis and credit markets seized up. It wasn't because stocks were wildly, wildly overvalued. And the fact that markets have rebounded so quickly and to such a great extent since 2009, I think is a reflection of the fact that it wasn't a bubble, that stocks were probably pretty reasonably valued in 2007, all things considered, because no rational participant in 2007, in late 2007, you know, really could have said, look, you know, in the next year, I think every investment bank in Wall Street is going to collapse and Lehman Brothers is going to go out of business and credit markets are going to completely seize up. I really don't think anyone could have rationally said that in 2007. So people who were buying stocks in October 2007, I don't think even in hindsight were doing anything that was that crazy or dumb. Now, and that's not true for something like the NASDAQ in 2000. You can look back at them and say, look, even in hindsight, that was ridiculous and you people were insane. So it's two very different ways to look at things. And I think just the point of that is that just because something falls a lot, even if it falls 50%, I don't think you can say that was a bubble. There are just a lot of unfortunate events that happen in the world that are unforeseeable. And if you're a long-term stock market investor, you're going to get caught up in a lot of those events. There are going to be wars that were unforeseeable and terrorist attacks that were unforeseeable and natural disasters that were unforeseeable. And a lot of those things will make either the market or the individual stocks that you own fall 50% or 30%. And that doesn't mean that you made a bad decision when you bought them. That's just part of investing over time. So
yeah, you can have a crash without a bubble preceding it. And
absolutely.
You know, 2007 probably wasn't the first time, nor will it likely be the last time that happened. And I think there's a lot of merit to your point in saying that, look, earnings are well above the high water mark then. We can't say that we were in an earnings bubble. It's very hard to argue that we were in a bubble relative to valuations. Unless, of course, you're of the stripe that believes that we're still in that bubble, which may be in another conversation. But to springboard off of that, why do we disagree, and we, I mean the collective investment world, so much about valuation, the macro environment? Why isn't there more consensus?
That's a really good question. I think there's no easy answer to that, but something that I think influences that quite a bit is that a lot of times when people are having debates about the economy or debates about valuation, that's just kind of a front for the real debate that they're really trying to get at, which is politics or some sort of moral debate about, what the Fed is doing morally right, or if people are upset about who lives in the White House or which party is controlling Congress. That's what they're really upset about, and those views are going to trickle down to their views about the stock market. So it's hard to prove this, and it's a touchy subject, but I'm willing to bet that a lot of the people who have been who think that the market is just in a crazy bubble over the last 5 years and that this is all unfounded and that the rally since 2009 has just been one big inflated bubble, I'm willing to bet that a lot of those people deep down are really just kind of bitter about who won the 2008 presidential election. That's kind of a harsh thing to say, and that alone will cause a much bigger debate and fiercer debate. But I really believe that a lot of macroeconomic debates are really just political debates, are really just political debates in disguise. And when you hear these people argue about it, sometimes you can see it. You can see right through to it. They say, look, the market is a bubble and this is crazy and it's all inflated. And then two or three sentences later, it's Obama's ruining this and doing this and the Fed's destroying the world this. And you can really kind of see, well, okay, that's what you're getting at. This is a political conversation. And a lot of the most bearish investors these days, when you read their commentaries, their monthly letters to investors, there's a little bit of finance mixed in with a lot of political rants in there. And I think that's true for everybody. Everybody has a political bias. I think every single person does. And it's really easy to point to other people and say, look how biased you're being. You have these political bias. But everybody has them. It influences how people think about the world. It's really dangerous, though, when you let your political beliefs interfere with your investing decisions.
Absolutely. And it doesn't just have to be politics either. You know, politics is sort of the big one and very easy to identify. You know, people who, like to rant and rave about Fed activity, there's usually a political bias there. But like you pointed out, we all carry our biases around with us, and it doesn't have to be political. It could be moral. It could be about how we use and derive energy on this planet. It could be about whether you should live in a big city or in rural America. It could be any of these things. And I think the question for investors is, are we capable of moving past these biases?
So about 2 years ago, I interviewed Robert Shiller, and he had a quote that I loved. He said, everybody thinks, I'm paraphrasing, but this is basically what he said. He said, everybody thinks that they can think for themselves, but they really can't, because everything you think and everything that you believe is a product of the people that you've met and the experiences that you've had in life. Yeah. And most of those experiences have been outside of your control. So you think you're thinking independently, but you're really not. You're influenced by the morals that your parents taught you, which were outside of your control, and the philosophies that you were taught in college, which were outside of your control based on, you know, who was your professor? What did he teach you? And that's going to stick with you. But maybe what if you had a different professor? What if you were born in India versus America? You would think completely differently about the world. And that's true for everybody. Like, everyone has these beliefs about how the world operates and what is ideal and what should happen. And just because people disagree with each other, it doesn't mean that, you know, it's really easy, I think, for people to say, look, you believe that, and that means you're an immoral person, or you're not as intelligent as I am. And it's just, I think we just have to accept that everyone has a different view of the world based on their own unique life experiences. And that's a lot of why we end up disagreeing with each other. One, I think, pretty fascinating story that goes along with this. I'll try to keep it short, but I think it's really fascinating. And not to make this too political, but I think this is an important point. The Koch brothers, who are obviously famous for their strong political views, there's a really interesting backstory about how that came about. And I'm pretty sure I'm getting this this right, but I'm recalling this from memory. But the Koch brothers' father came up with this oil technique for extracting oil that was really groundbreaking. I think this is back in the 1950s. And he tried to sell it in the United States, and no one was interested in it. No one wanted it. But who was very interested in this technique were the Soviets. So the Koch brothers' father moved to Russia, I think in the 1950s, 1960s, and worked with the Soviets for years on this oil technique. And he came back to America, and his lesson that he taught his sons, that he drilled into his sons when he moved back to America, was communism ruins everything. His experience in Russia was disastrous, and he just got a firsthand view of how what government influence can do to economies. And that was what the Koch brothers were brought up, drilled into them. And that makes a lot of sense. Like, I can totally see. So, yeah, I mean, you can just connect those dots and see how the Koch brothers' worldview today was influenced by their life experiences when they were young. And everyone goes through that to a certain extent. Like, how you were raised and what you believe is just a product of those unique experiences that you had when you were growing up.
Yeah, and that's something that you and I have actually both written about separately, which, and a lot of that is, what's the macro environment like as you're coming up through formative years? What does the market do when you start investing, or when you hear your parents talking about whether or not they can retire or pay for college for you? And then as your first 10 years as an investor, do you see 250% declines in the market and think that this is a rigged game and everything is working against you? Or does it happen to be 1988 and you get to run through, you know, one of the greatest bull markets of all time, and you become convinced that you would be an idiot to ever own anything other than large cap U.S. stocks?
Yeah, that makes a big influence on people, and not just for stocks too. But if you were growing up as a young person, middle aged person, in the 1970s, you experienced the wrath of inflation. Versus if you've been a young adult for the last 20 years, you really don't know what inflation is. Inflation to you was 2008 when it got up to like 4 or 5%. Versus if you grew up in the 70s, you experienced, you know, 13, 14% inflation. You just have a totally different view of what inflation can do to you. And there's nothing like, you know, it's possible for someone today to look back at the numbers and say, and see, oh, wow, they had really high inflation in the 1970s. But if you didn't live through it, I don't think, and I personally didn't, but if you didn't live through it, I think it's much harder to really understand what it can do to people. So I think living through things like the Great Depression or inflation in the 1970s or the 2008 crash, if you live through that and experience it, it's going to change your worldview forever. And the generations that did not experience that are just going to have a different view of the world. And I think that's just a long way of saying this is why we have fierce debates about economics and stock valuations and whatnot. There's some of it that is just comes down to misunderstanding. This is something that Colin Roach brings up a lot, is that a lot of people just really don't understand how QE works or how the monetary system works. And it's not really a debate when you can look at someone and say, look, you're just factually wrong about those views that you're saying. But there is a lot where equally smart people disagree about things, and that just comes down to your own unique worldview. And that will never go away. It's never going to get to a point where people agree on economics or people agree about markets. There's always going to be, I think, fierce debates, really polarizing debates about these things. So that will never end.
Right. And of these experiences that we can have that form us and provide us our worldviews, it seems that the thing that we take away the most is the fear of the worst case scenario. So, you know, if you went through the Depression, what you learned was the government decided to insure bank accounts, and that's where I'm putting my money.
Right.
And if you lived through the 70s, what you learned was inflation can destroy economies, and you should always be wary of what can happen.
And right. I mean, if you grew up during the Great Depression, they seized your gold. Whereas if it was 1970s, that's what you wanted to own was gold. So you get two completely different views on what you should do during a financial crisis. Like what is the worst case scenario? Is the worst case scenario, having inflation ruin your cash, so you should be in gold, or maybe the worst case scenario is the government seizes your gold. So it's, I mean.
Yeah, and we then carry these things around like giant burdens through the rest of our investing careers or lives, and they act like enormous roadblocks to our long-term success. If you were convinced that QE was going to cause runaway inflation that would destroy the U.S. dollar and you know, hamper stocks and economic growth in this country, think about the decisions that you would have made. Well, you only have to look at Peter Schiff to decide, you know, what those consequences would have been. But if you had piled into gold and, you know, avoided long-term treasuries and avoided stocks of all stripes, the opportunity cost there is, it's irrecoverable.
It was massive. And I think there are two points to make on what you just said. One is that there's always a tendency to fight the last war. And there's a tendency to think that this recession is going to mirror the last recession or some past recession that we've had. And I think that was what a lot of people got wrong in 2008, is they just instantly kind of anchored to the 1970s. And said, like, look, this is what bad monetary policy can do. Or they anchored to like Zimbabwe or the, you know, right. Germany in 1920s. You always go back to these past episodes and sort of assume that the future is going to look like, you always assume that the current future is going to mimic one of those past episodes. And it never does. You know, there's always that saying that the four most dangerous words are "this time it's different." And people like love that quote, and they say, you know, it's just sort of axiomatic that that's a great quote. I totally disagree with the view that that is a true quote, because I think it is always different this time. Every single recession we have is different, and there are no two recessions or no two market environments, no two market responses that are similar. So there's always a tendency for people to say, okay, you know, what year is this like? It's 2009 or it's 2014. What year is that like? Is this like 1974? Is this like 1929? Like,
here,
no,
let me grab an S&P chart and overlay them and show you.
That's the peak of stupidity, is when people overlay those charts. That's just completely moronic. But even if you're not even overlaying, if you're just saying like, what is this similar to? Is this similar to 1929? The answer is always no. It's always different this time. Because I think the factors that are going to influence crises come down to these really minute events, like Lehman Brothers going bankrupt. Like, that's what really, really threw the financial crisis in 2008 over the edge. But of course, Lehman Brothers was not any issue in 1929. So to say, you know, it's 2008, and then you're going to look back at 1929 and say, well, how did that end up? Well, these are two completely different events. The only thing that they have in common is that they were really bad. Like, that's really the only thing they have in common.
So I'll correct you there. The other thing that they have in common is then the end result is that markets recover.
That's true.
And I think, you know, if there's value in the it's different this time, quote, being dangerous. And I agree with you. Every economic environment is different. This, we're talking about extremely complex adaptive systems that are not linear or not predictable, except for the fact that it has always remained true. And I will say that there is some World War III scenario where this is not the case, but it has always remained true that that being optimistic in the long run has paid off.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I think it's definitely true, too, if you're diversified globally, because people can say, well, what about Japan? You know, the markets there has been stagnant for 20 some odd years. Well, don't own just one country's equities. Don't own 100% Japanese equities. If you're globally diversified and you own something like the Vanguard Total World Stock Market Index, which is basically giving you the biggest slice of global equities that you can own, then for that, I really think there is no historical precedent for a crash that does not recover. That's not to say that it couldn't happen in the future. Like you said, you could have some World War III scenario that we can't contemplate that could, you know, completely throw this out, where all global currencies just go to hell in a handbasket. You could contemplate something, but the odds are pretty strong that owning a diverse global basket of equities over a long period of time will be a pretty decent bet.
Why do you think? I'm going to make an assumption, and the assumption is that as people get older, they become less optimistic about the future.
Well,
number one,
are...
how do you feel about, let me state, Morgan and I are both very young. And so, you know, chalk this up to our naivete. But number one, attack or defend my assumption. And number two, why or why not?
Well, with the caveat of, yes, we're young people, so maybe this is a foolish question for us to answer. Maybe some of it is that, you know, people, as you get older, you just get more cynical because you see how the sausage is made, so to speak. So your experience with politics and your experiences with work life just leave you kind of jaded. Maybe some of it is as people get older, they got kind of disappointed in themselves that they didn't live up to their past goals, and that just makes them kind of cynical with life. That in itself is a cynical view, but maybe that's some of it. Maybe some of it as an investor is that you're kind of running out of time. So it's easy for you and I to say, oh, have a 20-year view. But if you're 70 years old, you can't do that. If you're 70 years old and you say, look, my life expectancy is 10 more years. So if the market just crashed, I can't just say, oh, wait 20 years and don't worry, you'll make your money back. If you're 75 or 80 years old and the market crashes, like that might be it for you. You know, that might be your last experience as an investor. So it's that's something I think a lot about, is that for people like you and I, it's very easy to have this really long-term view and say, oh, over 20 years, markets have always done pretty well. Well, for someone who is retired, that's not really an acceptable answer. And then so you can say, well, look at maybe, you know, you should have a diverse portfolio of bonds and cash and other assets. Don't be 100% in stocks. And then people come out and say, well, look, I need the growth of stocks, but the stability of bonds. That's what retirees need. And that's the only answer for them is good luck. And that I think leaves them kind of cynical about markets in general.
Well, you know, from a behavioral perspective too, that also leaves people open to being gullible to the worst of investment scams, to lesser really expensive insurance products that are much more hype than substance.
Yeah, because what everybody wants is what does not exist and will never exist, which is stock-like returns with bond-like stability. Like that doesn't and that will never exist.
And it's yet we have investment banks, insurance companies, you know, mutual fund companies even desperately scrambling to try to structure that, or at least convince people that they have structured that.
Right. And that, I mean, that's why hedge funds, I think, are so popular and can get away with charging so much fees, is that they sell the idea that they can deliver that we can give you 10% returns year in and year out, come hell or high water. Like, that's a dream for pension funds or wealthy investors. It's like, absolutely.
You and me.
Give me that. For you. Yeah, of course. Who wouldn't want that? But I think when you're searching for that and you're trying to structure your investment portfolio around that, I think you're much more likely to get the opposite. You're much more likely to get bond-like returns with stock-like volatility when you're searching for that. Because I think inevitably what that comes down to when people are trying to structure those products, it just comes down to leverage. They say, that's how we're going to do this. We're going to take what looks like a riskless investment and leverage it to the hilt. And that's how we're going to get high returns with lower volatility. And
somehow, amazingly, we have failed to learn from long-term capital management or securitized real estate debt that every time we try to do this, it blows up.
The allure of it, I think, is so great that it's too hard to learn from the past. And not only that, but the rewards for selling those products can be so great that the amount of effort that goes into selling them and convincing the public that that they can deliver those returns with lower volatility. You know, you can make so much money as a hedge fund manager doing that, that you will find a way to convince people that you are capable of doing that. Because just earning 2 and 20, even if you deliver mediocre returns, you're going to make an ungodly fortune from that anyways. So
if we've identified that we're deeply flawed, and you know, I'm sure we could spend 2 hours talking about our favorite books on the topic. You know, one of the first, I'll say, quote unquote, real investment books I ever read was The Psychology of Investing by John Nofsinger. It's this tiny little 80-page book that basically, in my opinion, laid the framework for, you know, thinking fast and slow or irrationally exuberant and, you know, sort of all of the well-known names in that space. All of behavioral finance acknowledges the same thing, which is we are deeply flawed. We make irrational decisions because of herding, because of mental accounting, because of overconfidence. If all these things are established and true, number one, why haven't we fixed this already? And number two, how can we fix it if we can?
I think why haven't we fixed it? I think just like you were saying, the allure of markets that you can, you know, the allure of riches over time as an investor, and the incentives as a salesman are so great that we're never going to fix this. There's always going to be so much money from investors getting excited about how much they can earn and salesmen getting excited about how big a commission they can make. Those two will always have so much money in it that I don't think we'll never get rid of this, with the exception of ridiculous regulations that prevent it. You're never going to take that away. I think humans will always have this idea that even if 99% of other people have failed doing it, that they're part of the 1% that's going to succeed at doing it. That's what everyone's going to think about themselves.
I think it was earlier this year, somebody at Schwab, it was either Bernie Clark or maybe even Chuck Schwab, said, you know, 98% of investors should just own index funds. And of course, the problem with that comment is everybody thinks they're the 2%.
Of course.
I mean, absolutely. You and I are pretty bright guys. Maybe we're the 2%.
Maybe, but probably not, but maybe, right? So back in May, I was at a CFA conference in Seattle, and there were 1,500 institutional investors there. And Carl Richards, who writes for the New York Times, he's a great financial writer, wrote the book The Behavior Gap, was talking about those statistics, about, you know, over a 20-year period, 98% of mutual fund managers won't beat their benchmark. And what Carl said is that not a single person in this room thinks they're part of that 98%. Every single one of you thinks you're part of the 2%. And he's right. Like, not one of those investors is going to stand up and walk out of the room and say, you know, Carl, you're right. I'm done. I probably can't beat my benchmark. So I'm going to close my fund and go find something else to do. Nobody's going to say that, because you can make so much money doing it. You know, if you're a mediocre mutual fund manager and you never outperform your benchmark, just earning a 1% return on your $1 billion in assets, you can still make a lot of money doing that.
And that's assuming that you're willing to admit that you might be part of the 98%. Because the first hurdle they have to overcome is their own overconfidence, is to say, you're right, I can't do this. Very few people are going to be willing to admit that they're wrong.
No, and I think part of that is because investors like Warren Buffett have made it sound so easy.
Yeah.
They make it sound like, oh, you just go out and find some good businesses.
Just buy good companies.
Just buy good companies and hold on.
Like, nobody else has had that idea.
it sounds so easy. So that not only if you're a mutual fund manager, but even if you're just Joe on the street, you hear that and you say, I can do that. I could totally do that. And obviously, it's just so much more difficult than it sounds. And that's why no one has been able to really emulate Buffett's returns, at least for the amount of time that he's earned them for. But that too, I think, will never go away. I don't think it'll ever go away that people will lose hope that they can be part of that tiny minority. But I think something else that you were talking about when you said, how can we get over this? One thing that I believe in that I think a lot of people might disagree with, but it's something that I'm pretty feel strongly about, is that the one thing that markets will not be that markets will not be able to discount, that they're not that that they can't really price into stocks, is a very long-term outlook. Yeah, and if the general market is really focused on the next 6 months or the next year, which is probably about what they're looking at, but you have the disposition and the personality to be able to look at the next 5 or 10 or 20 years, that I think is an edge that people can exploit over most investors. The problem is that most people don't have that disposition that they can really say, I'm investing for the next 20 years and I don't care what stocks are going to do in the next 5 or 10 years because I'm here for the next 20 years.
Right. It was really easy to say that this year. In 2014, that was easy to say. But in 2008,
sure, it's easy to say then, but you know, when 2008 comes around, then a lot of people realize that it's a lot easier to say I'll be greedy when others are fearful than it is to actually do that. But you know, if you do have that personality, and you know, from my experience, I would say, I don't have any studies about this, but I would say in my experience, probably something like 10% of investors do have the disposition to be able to be truly long-term thinkers. Those people, I think, can certainly outperform the average investor, or maybe even outperform the markets over very long periods of time. It's still a small minority of people, but I think that's the skill that people want, is not necessarily the ability to tear apart company balance sheets, or you know, to have any sort of insider information, or to be a math whiz, or to have the best algorithm. I think the skill people want is the ability to be able to think 20 years into the future.
Can that be taught?
And to be able to delay gratification for 20 years in the future.
Can you teach people that?
I think you can try to influence that people, but I think the majority of it is something you're born with. I really think that's true. I mean, I really think some people have the ability to think long term and others don't. And maybe you can teach it. You can help uncover that hidden side in some people. But I think there are truly some people that are pretty much doomed in the stock market. They don't have the personality to be able to hold out in the long run. And since markets will always crash, we're never going to get rid of crashes or volatility. And if those people are going to pull the trigger and sell as soon as there's a crash, those people really are doomed as market investors. One thing that's good, I think, and this gets overlooked a lot, is that the average investor out there really is truly passive. They invest in stocks through their 401k. They maybe look at their statement once a year. And other than that, they really don't give a damn about what's going on there. They don't watch CNBC. They don't watch Jim Cramer. They don't check their portfolios every day. They really don't know what the stock market is, other than the fact that they contribute to it in their 401k and they hope for the best. And I think there's a tendency for people like you and I and other market commentators to really have, I think, maybe a dim view on the average investor because of what we see going on out there. But if you look at data from Vanguard or Fidelity, even during market crashes like in 2008 or the big pullback that we had in 2011, something like 90 or 95% in 2011, it was 98% of Vanguard investors didn't make a single change to their portfolio. And that's fantastic. And through their 401k, they're basically dollar cost averaging into low cost funds and never doing anything else but that. And that's great. So even though there is a lot of really bad behavior out there from active investors who are trying to fiddle with their portfolios left and right, I think there is a lot to be said that there are a huge number of investors out there through their own blissful ignorance that are doing a pretty good job at investing. And as more and more companies auto-enroll people in 401ks, in life cycle funds, that are investing them in a low-cost fund that's going to slowly, gradually decrease stock exposure into bonds. And the investor doesn't know anything about it. He doesn't know what fund he's in. He doesn't know anything about it other than, you know, $300 comes out of every check and it goes somewhere for retirement. That's a good thing. I think the more blissfully ignorant we can get investors about long-term investors, the better off they will be over time. I think there's just too much evidence that the more people try, the worse they're going to do. And the more that people we can get people to be hands off about it and kind of forget about it, the better people will do over time.
Yeah. I hope you're right. I have my doubts about whether or not that's the majority of people. But I do hope you're right. You know, I think my favorite piece of this whole behavioral finance conversation is, I think it's in Thinking Fast and Slow at the end of the book, he basically says, look, there's no evidence that knowing about this does any good for you. That people who are well informed about their behavioral bias act no differently than those who know nothing about it. And in fact, more intelligent people are often more likely to be subjected to behavioral errors because of overconfidence.
Well, who was it that came up with the capital asset pricing model? I have a story about that. I can't remember the name, though. The person who won the Nobel Prize for that. Was it...
It was Sharpe or somebody in that vein, or Markowitz.
That's who it was. It was Markowitz. Thank you. So there was an interview with him, I think about 10 years ago. They're talking about the capital asset pricing model, which, of course, you know, is this math-based model that's teaching you things about asset allocation, the perfect mix that you can have between risk and reward. And they asked Markowitz, how do you invest? He said, I'm 50% stocks, 50% bonds. I just leave it alone. I figure that's good enough.
It's good enough.
So here's a person who won the Nobel Prize for coming up for this really sophisticated formula on asset allocation. And even he himself just kind of throws up his hands and is like, it's just kind of index 50-50. That's good enough. That'll get me to my goals close enough. I think stories like that are really telling, that people like Kahneman that are beyond experts in this, they're just like Yodas in these fields. And people people who come up with the capital asset pricing model, who just know this stuff more than anyone else, and are so smart about the math side of investing, or even so smart about the psychology side of investing. Like you said, there's really no evidence that knowing that is going to make you a better investor. You know, if that was true, Daniel Kahneman would be Warren Buffett, right?
Right.
I mean, if all you need to do was be an expert in behavioral finance, Daniel Kahneman would be the best hedge fund manager in the world. And we've talked to Kahneman about how we invest. He's probably the most cynical person I've ever met about investing, to the point where, you know, I think even his views on indexing, he's kind of cynical about. He's just cynical about markets altogether. So he's beyond a hands-off approach. He's just kind of, you know, just earn your money from your career and leave it at that kind of thing. He has this great story where he comes to a financial advisor and he says, I'm not concerned with earning money in the market. All I want to do is give you my money and just don't lose it. Just keep it safe. I just want to hold on to my money. And his financial advisor says, I can't work with you. There's nothing I can do for you. Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, I think what this all comes down to, sort of the pyramid of what we've been talking about for the last 30 minutes, is that when I write and talk to investors, I just advocate humility. That's really what this comes down to. People just need to be have a better awareness of how humble we need to be in markets, because there is so much evidence that the more people try, the worse they do. And to me, that is just a sign of how humble we need to be, that we don't know what markets are going to do over the next year or over the next 10 years. We don't know when the next recession is going to be. We don't know when interest rates are going to rise. We really just need to be more humble about this. And that's not to say that we just completely throw up our hands, because I think there are things we can learn about asset allocation, things that we can learn about market cycles and whatnot. But I really think the more we fiddle with our portfolios, the worse we're going to do.
Sure. I mean, the Fidelity report that the best performing investors were the ones that forgot they had accounts. I mean,
right.
we laugh about that, but...
We laugh at that story and then we instantly go and fiddle with our accounts.
Right. Then it's like, wait, is my allocation right? Maybe I should have more in emerging markets. It's like,
right.
Were you listening at all? Right. And, you know, and I, to echo your comment, I agree. People, we should be much less confident about the things we think we know. you know, even if you had in your mind the full data set of modern financial markets, it's such a limited period of time,
right,
that to go and say, well, this is the evidence and I'm 1,000% confident in it, we have to say, think about how short of a time period we're really talking about here. You know, three non-overlapping 30-year periods is, I mean, that's basically what we're working with. That's nothing.
And that's absolutely true. And to a bigger extent, the number of historical crashes that we have, it's really like, you know,
six, maybe four, five, six
that we can look at going back to the Great Depression. That's nothing. If you were doing if you were doing some study or some analysis on history or psychology or biology or ecology or something, and your sample size was six, you would get laughed out of the room and no one would take you seriously. But that's what we do with markets. We look at, you know, the history since the Great Depression and we say, you know, the market returns 6% and you have a crash every X years and, you know, crashes are usually this big and they recover in this period of time. And I think there is some value into that. There is some value in looking at the last 100 years of history, but it is definitely a limited sample set. And it's absolutely wrong to look at the last 100 years of history and say, well, the worst case scenario is X right, or the best case scenario is X, and use the last 70 years of history to form those grounds. I think that is completely, totally wrong.
Yeah. And then leverage it up 30 or 40 times based on your math.
Which is what a lot of people do. And they almost invariably end up bankrupt doing that. But the odds are really strong that over the next 50 years that you and I will be investors, we're going to learn something. We're going to learn a lot of things that the last 70 years of data could not teach us. We're going to be surprised by a lot of things over the next 50 years. And think of yourself as an investor in 1950. You know, what happened over the next 70 years that the history before 1970 could not have taught you, could not have warned you about? There's a tremendous about things with technology and high frequency trading and geopolitics and globalization that you could not have known in 1950, but that proved to be true over the ensuing half century.
And the other side of that is the things that you were worried about were the wrong things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, I mean, that just gets back to recency bias, that people really think that the next 10 years are going to look like the last 10 years. And that's why, you know, after gold has gone up 400%, people want gold. And, you know, it's just this natural tendency to extrapolate recent trends. But I think if you look back at history, that's rarely the case. It's almost always the case that the biggest news story of the next 10 years is something that no one was talking about whatsoever at the beginning of that 10-year period. Yeah. You know, if this was the year 2000 and you were looking ahead and saying, what's going to be the biggest news story of the next 10 years from 2000 to 2010, there is no possible way that you could have said 9/11, which was the biggest news story of that decade. It was impossible to know that. Or if it was 1935 and you were trying to say, what's the biggest news story of the next 10 years, you could not have said World War II that's going to kill 80 million people. You just could not have known that. And I think pretty much all of history are events like that. You can use the word black swan if you want. I think it's an overused word. But that's basically what it is, you know, that things are so unforeseeable. The big events that matter are so unforeseeable. There are things that we can foresee and predict, but those events by and large don't always matter that much. Because I think if something is predictable, it's probably already priced in and people are already planning for it and they can work around it. It's the big events that you don't see coming that really shape the world and matter, because just the fact that people can't see them coming makes them so much more devastating or groundbreaking when they do happen.
Right. And the negative things, the negative things tend to be these huge one-time global, lately geopolitical events. And to the upside, it seems a much quieter sense of progress that comes when we're not even really paying attention.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I think the downside events are things like World War II, that was, you know, a 6-year period, a very short period in the grand scheme of things. It was a blink in the eye in the grand scheme of things, but killed 80 million people and was the most devastating event of modern history and completely reshaped the world. Or 9/11, which happened in 2 hours, right, or an hour and a half, whatever that morning was, but completely reshaped global politics. So those downside events happen very, very quickly. But the upside events really happen slowly. And it's not until you take a step back and look at data and say, wow, in the last 20 years, we've made a lot of progress. We like,
right, look at life expectancy, infant mortality, you know, poverty, all of these things.
And I think that's true in the stock market too, that bear markets tend to be very quick, sudden, abrupt, violent events, whereas bull markets happen much more slowly over 10 or 20 year periods. And it's really not until you've looked back over the last 10 years or the last 20 years and say, wow, the stock market's done extremely well. Even if people are skeptical about it and they keep talking about the crash of 2008, you look at it over the last 20 years and say, hey, we've done really well. But, you know, it's something I bring up a lot about, you know, is stocks in 2008, the S&P 500 fell about 35%, 38%, I think it was. Right. In 2013, it went up about the same amount, 32% or something. The magnitude of those was about the same. But how people remember it is so different.
Did anyone notice that the market was up 32% in 2013?
I mean, the crash of 2008 will be in the history books forever. And people will be talking about it 50 years from now as this extraordinary event. But the bull market of 2013 that was the same magnitude, no one remembers it. There are some really fascinating studies from that Franklin Templeton does every year. They interview 1,000 investors. And at the end of the year, they say they just ask people, how much did the S&P 500 grow up this year? And people just give their thoughts about how much it went up. And they are so wrong. The average guess is so wrong. It's just hilarious. And you get these times like in 2013 where the market went up, I think it was 32%. And in Franklin Templeton's surveys, the average investor thought it went up like 4%. And like there's just such this massive disconnect during bull markets that people don't have during bear markets. People are so attuned during bear markets and they know exactly how much money they lost and it gets so emotional. But during bull markets, people can just kind of tune out, and especially bull markets that pan out over a 5 or 10 year period, people just don't pay that much attention to them. And that's true for everything in life. I think it's one of the things it's very true in is medicine. That if you look at medicine, the progress that medicine has made over the last 30 years, it is astounding. But no one really talks about it that much because it happened very slowly. And it's not something where you're going to turn on the NBC Nightly News and it's going to say, breaking news, medicine made this profound breakthrough discovery today.
Yeah, or like, how about like...
It doesn't work like that. But when
people
you look
don't
at,
die of HIV in the majority anymore.
Right, and that's
we just don't, and it's just not news. We just don't talk about it. It doesn't exist.
Right, if you look at the decline in HIV deaths from 1995 through today, it's mind blowing how much progress we've made. But no one talks about it because it took 20 years to occur, and it happened slowly over those 20 years. But really, I mean, in 1995, if you had AIDS, that was more or less a death sentence. That was a very, very bad thing to have. You get AIDS today, it is a highly not curable, but maintainable illness. And people, I think that progress is so overlooked in society, whereas the downsides are so fretted upon and people just latch onto them. And it's really unfortunate because over long periods of time, society and markets make so much progress. And for the most part, that progress is ignored. And that's really sad, but it's true. And I think that'll always be true.
I agree. We are going to run out of time before I let you go. So short of, you know, unplugging all connection from the world and turning off our statement deliveries, give me one or two things investors can do in the current environment to hold back their behavioral flaws.
I think you have to really understand yourself. And there's a tendency in investing, you know, what everyone wants to do in investing is know their risk tolerance. And what a lot of people do when they're trying to assess their risk tolerance is they try to guess how they would feel if the market fell 30% and make this prediction about how they would react and how they would feel. It's a prediction in the future, trying to guess your future emotions. And I think that's just a terrible way to judge your own behavior. And I think the best predictor of your future behavior is your past behavior. So as an investor, you need to look back at your past behavior and say, how did I react in 2008? Did I panic and sell? If I did, then that is the best indication that I'm probably going to panic and sell during the next crash, that your past behavior is going to be very indicative of your future behavior. So my advice would just be to implore people to say, go back and look at what you did during the dot-com bubble or the 2008 crash. How did you respond as an investor? How did you react? What did you do with your money? And if anything, use that as an anchor to your own behavioral flaws. And if during 2008, if you really held firm and you didn't sell and you maybe you added to your investment, then that's great. Then you probably are truly a long-term investor. If you're not, then I think you need to be honest with yourself and say, maybe you need a higher allocation to less volatile assets like bonds and cash. Maybe that's just who you are, and you need to accept who you are rather than pretending that you're a long-term investor and then learning the hard way that you're not. And I'll end with this great quote from Jason Zweig, who says, the stock market is a very expensive place to learn what kind of person you are.
That's great. Morgan, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for being part of Fireside Markets.
Thanks for having me.
For additional information, details regarding references made in today's episode, or to subscribe or comment on this podcast, visit us online at basinasset.com.